It is my great pleasure to introduce to you my old friend and colleague, Christine Marie Mason. And Christine and I have known each other for about 15 years since there was a yoga retreat that we went on in 2001. And since then, I have come to know her very well, but in reading her new book, I found out that there was a vast area of her life and experience that I knew nothing about. And in her new book, she shares a lot of these stories with us. And one second here. And Christine is uniquely qualified to write this book, Indivisible, Coming Home to Our Deep Connection. She has such a broad range of experiences. She's been a mother of four, and then two more from another marriage. She has served in ROTC. She has been the serial CEO of many tech companies. She started her own tech companies. She has served as a peace mentor in prisons. She has been exposed to a lot of different kinds of life experiences involving violence, and whether that was witnessing a revolution in Iran or witnessing the fighting that happened in her own family when she was growing up, or hearing about the murder of her mother when she was 12 years old, or the experiences she had in her marriages. She has been a firsthand witness of what violence can do. And her book is really a story about how we can think about that Rumi line that's off-quoted about how don't seek to find love, but seek to remove the barriers that you have in yourself to the acceptance of love and bring it into your life, and how the core wound of humans in this world is disconnection and isolation. And so she's written this book, which is poetic and elegiac and kind of about self-growth and some very specific techniques. At the same time, super-duper personal and warm and revelatory in that way. And it's profound in so many ways that I really can't categorize it. So I'm thrilled to have her here today on this call, on the very day of the release of her book, to have her tell us about the genesis of this book, what it means to her, and how we can apply its principles to lead more connected lives. Christine, thanks for being on the call. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Okay.
Ah, oh, thank goodness. Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for the intro, and that was a pretty amazing intro. As you were talking, I thought, you know, I've done a lot of things, huh? But then I thought I was just, I'd lived a very long life, and you can sure get a lot done over many, many years. Yeah, today's the launch day of the book, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And how did the book start? I understand that it's a very personal book, and you often hesitated about which parts to include, whether it was too private, too personal, too close to home, and you finally decided to put it out in its current form. So I'd be very curious, and I'm sure the audience is too, about how this all came about.
You know, I think there's a lot of gender questioning myself on gender things that were involved in the delay of releasing the book. You know, I spent a lot of my life trying to make it in a man's world effectively, you know, doing software stuff and doing investment stuff. And, you know, to do that, I had to be very serious-minded. And all of the work that I had done on the other part of my life, raising a family, living in a very heart-centered way, doing spiritual practice, was stuff that I kept largely to myself for a really long time. And I think I was concerned on some deep level about being so self-revealing that I would lose credibility in the areas of the world that I had done well in. You know, why don't I write a tech book or write an innovation book or something like that? But when it, as I sort of went deeper into that question of why didn't I want to reveal that stuff, there seemed to be a little bit of having internalized a sense of not appreciating what might generally be considered feminine values, Like the very things that were motivating me to grow, change, connect, the things that were making the biggest difference in the way that I was living every day, those were the most valuable activities that were going on, and yet I was worried about sharing them. So when I finally got over that barrier, the book really flowed. And I think there was another factor in it, which was some self-doubt about whether it was worthy to share. You know, everybody's got such an amazing life experience on some level. Why my voice? Why would I write this? You know, and that was overcome through a couple of friends who really did believe that it was worth taking the time to write down, and it flowed from that.
Well, I am glad you did, and the results. I'm guessing that the audience will very much appreciate what you've done. So now. A big part of the book is about trauma, like foundational traumas, like having your mom pass away when you're young, or any number of other things, like being uprooted from your home and family. And people often have a choice of either going the direction of having the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or having the recovery response, the post-traumatic growth. So can you talk about what makes people resilient, or what makes them collapse under the weight of trauma and stress?
I think, sometimes I wonder if that's not grace. I remember I talked to this guy, his story is in the book, this guy Chuck, and when he was a young guy, eight, nine, ten, he had a really abusive dad. He was living in Appalachia, and he had this dog. And his father came home one night drunk and told the kid, take your don't like the looks of that dog. Take him out back and shoot him. I don't want to ever see that dog again. And Chuck talks about, in those days where he lived, you either did what your father said or it was you that was going to get punished. And he obeyed his father and made a decision in the moment that he was committing that act that he would never hurt another being, and ended up going out and saving hundreds and hundreds of dogs. Ended up being sort of a rescue dog guy well into his 50s. And I wondered, his story too. It's not just my story or anybody else's, that there are fundamental opportunities to say, does the thing that traumatized me break me, or does it create a unique place from which I can serve? Like, if I look at abandonment and violence and all of those kinds of things that happened to me, I can say, oh, I'm such a victim. Or I can say, wow, I think I never want to have that happen to anyone else again. And how can I make a difference in that? How can I help stop the cycle from perpetuating? I don't think it's automatic. It's not just a single decision. I definitely lived the first part of my adult life in the echo of the anger and violence of my youth, but it just eventually got so uncomfortable that I started looking for lifelines here and there. And once I saw that there was one lifeline, and then there was another, and then there was another, and pretty soon it was evident that I could take the steps needed to fix anything that was causing internal pain in my life or pain with me and someone else, that there was always a solution. And it had this virtuous cycle where every time I made one positive step forward, two or three more lines would appear, and I'd be weaving this beautiful basket lifting me up. So I think the willingness to seek solution and to keep growing and to grab onto those lifelines is what makes the difference. That's also supported by the neuroplasticity discoveries in science and stuff on how the brain changes. The minute you make one positive shift, others become available.
Well, that sounds fantastic, and I'm a big fan of practicality. I promised our readers and our listeners that we talk about also ways of making this happen. So somebody's had trauma, somebody's had a hardship. This fellow you talked about, who went to rescue dogs, he made a vow and he took action. So what can other people do to self-soothe, self-heal, and head towards the path of self-growth?
Mm. There are so many things. I mean, I'm talking a lot in the book about the art and practice of connection, but one of the first that generally is like between oneself and another creature or being or something else in the world. But I think the first step in connection is the connection to your own reality, your own truth. There are so many, I feel, a lot of conditioned places in the culture where you get told that this is the way to be, this is the way to feel, this is what's acceptable, this is what you're valued for, that we can start layering those onto ourselves to the point where we don't actually know how we really feel in a situation. Or we have turned our attention, you know, I did this for a long time where I turned what would have been an internal ability to take care of what I needed and look to get that from somewhere else. I still sometimes I'll be wishing that someone will say something to me that I want to hear. And finally I learned this practice where I say it to myself. I'm like, oh, Christine, you're so blankety blank. And I watch how that feels in my body. And it's an instant soothing. I just took the need and turned around and gave it to what I needed from someone else, turned around and gave it to myself. So I think the connection, the first step in connection is getting reconnected to what your own truth is, to your own true value, trying to unwind those messages that may have gotten in the way of that. And then the next place is to look at what I do next is where I'm in the world and having a hard time, feeling alone or feeling lonely or something like that. I often notice that my isolation is coming out of some insecurity or something where I'm very aware, hyper aware of my own being, embarrassed or something like that might come up. And so to make the conscious shift into when I walk into this room, when I walk into this party, into this dinner, into the grocery store, that my goal is going to be to put connection with another person first. Over competition, over insecurity, over trying to prove myself, but to actually pause and make eye contact and seek to see a person soul to soul. That is a daily practice that I think is life changing. So those are a couple of places. It's kind of strange to talk, by the way, into this into a group of people who you can't see. So if you're nodding vigorously or you're shaking your head like I'm crazy, I have no idea. So,
well, my job here is to prevent the crazy from happening by giving some kind of, well-timed grunt and feedback. And that way, you're not
Thank
just
you.
Crazy talking to your computer screen. I've been doing this for 11 years, talking in an empty room to a computer. So I hear you. So looking into other people's lives, you mentioned in the book the whole idea of widgetization and cubbyholing of people as soon as you meet them. So what's an alternative to that? So you say look into their eyes and acknowledge that they are a whole person. So what's a way of doing that? You mentioned going to a party or an event or something like that.
Well, one thing is like, do not ever ask what do you do as your first question at a party. What I'm noticing is there's a lot of transactional behavior. Maybe it's culturally learned where you're sort of like, hi, where are you from? What do you do? And people spit out rote responses. And you don't really get at anything that's super meaningful about them. Maybe what they do right now has got nothing to do with what turns them on. So even in the space of what kind of questions do you ask people? Like, so you can start with something simple like, what did you do today? Or how was your day? Tell me something about your day. And you might find like a little bit of personal narrative that comes out, like what's up for them in the moment. Or, what are you most excited about? Or is there anything that you've read recently or seen recently that you think is an absolute must? And I have a list of those kinds of questions that I've offered as a supplement piece of information. But engaging with people in a way that says, I'm really interested in the fullness of who you are as a human being. I'm not going to look at you and put a whole bunch of labels on you, first of all, when I see you and decide whether or not you're worth talking to. I'm going to actually approach, ask deep questions, and then super hyper focus on your answer. Like see if I can tune into your breathing and actually really, really pay attention to the answer, not scan the room and look over your shoulder or see if there's somebody more interesting, but like drop fully into presence and see what happens. It's pretty amazing because people, that quality of attention is fairly unusual. So it's not even as much the content as it is, I want to know who you are and carry that intention to into your meetings with new people, even with your...
Not only is that powerful for you, but it's also powerful for the recipient. And the number of times that that's happened to me, I can count on, you know, maybe not one hand, but a couple of hands. And I believe you were one of those people who did that when we first met. And, you know, every time that's happened since, that bond has perpetuated itself through time. And it's become the basis of a friendship that was much more likely to last as opposed to having that kind of transactional interaction that you mentioned.
Mm. Just one more thing on that. Like, I kind of visualize it as if I was I had a membrane around me. And the membrane is somewhat porous. Things go out, things come in. But when I go into that mode of I am here to, you know, open the ports with another person, I lose the sense of my own self and ego for a short period of time. And it's almost a mystical place to connect from. That when I am not worried about what I'm going to say in response or how do I look pretty or what do they think of me or how am I going to impress this person? When I lose all of those common psychosocial weirdnesses and I just go into that open port place, it is such a flow state so that eventually becoming interested and wanting that meeting at the heart level or at the lung level, the breathe, wanting that meeting with another soul becomes almost a spiritual practice, even though it's just going to a cocktail party.
That is beautiful. And it's also something that's available to us every day, and people forget. They think that, oh, you're supposed to do this some kind of workshop, or, oh, no, I can't do this here. But the fact is that we are surrounded by the sacred and the holy, and it's completely open to you at any time. And I think that's one of the big things that your book demonstrates and really emphasizes. So everybody take that one thing to heart, and I think that's enough to transform a life right there. That's the interpersonal part. The book also talks all about the intrapersonal aspect of connection. And even though we met at a yoga retreat, it turns out that yoga did not come entirely naturally to you. So tell us about how you started going to yoga from being a somewhat harried corporate tech executive and then all the way to becoming a yoga teacher.
Oh, my gosh. I was living in Chicago at the time, and the kids were, you know, grammar school age, and I had four kids. And I was running this company. It was a company that I had started with a friend of mine. It was the first dot-com boom. Walking down the street, cranky, disheveled, and I see my friend David Sabin, who at the time was running Salt and Maxim, this company that makes the George Foreman grill and a bunch of other gadgets. And he looked stunning. He, like, glowing, bright eyes, you know, a little bit tan, very lean. I said, you know, whoa, what happened to you? And he said, yoga happened to me, and you look terrible, and you're coming with me. I'll pick you up Friday at lunchtime, and I'll take you to class, and we'll see what happens. And I got there, and I could hardly breathe. I could barely touch my toes, not even. And the pose at the end of class for anybody who's practiced is called Shavasana. It's the Shiva pose or the death pose. And you lay there flat on your back in sort of this halfway state between sleeping and waking. And it was the first time that I'd relaxed in a really long time. And there are T-shirts now that say, I'm just here for the Shavasana. But that is, in fact, what kept bringing me back. You know, that I could relax, I could breathe. And it was the first time in that period of my life when I felt an anxiety sort of melt away. And so I went straight into that practice, and I started going a lot. And pretty soon I was, you know, standing on my hands and doing back bends and then adding the breathing work and the meditation work. And I felt this hunger that every time I exposed another layer of this philosophy that or this body-mind practice, and not just the mental stuff about it, that there was another level to go to, and it was providing a portal. I've been in a religious community in other times of my life, church and stuff, but I'd never been in a personal spiritual practice like that where you were meditating, you're using your body, you're doing self-inquiry, you're practicing, first do no harm, which is the principle of yoga that got me. And that practice took me all the way through into this reconciliation stuff, where I was teaching a little bit on teaching the mornings and the weekends, teaching in a fighting gym up in Santa Rosa in California to a population that generally wouldn't get yoga, so I was going in and working with those guys. And then I saw a flyer for this yoga in prisons program that James Fox was running. We trained to be a yoga teacher in prison. And I was having this sort of moment of like, oh, I'm such a good person. I think I'll go teach yoga in prison. But I got to the training class and I'm sitting in the circle, and this story is in the book. So, it's a little bit of a repeat for anybody who actually gets this. This is in the free download part too. So I'll just tell it, but you'll get a little feeling tone behind it. I'm sitting in this room, this beautiful, serene room, and this guy sitting in the middle of the circle, and he's looking completely like a Buddha, just totally calm, very centered, and he says, "My name is Rusty. I spent 34 years in San Quentin for the murder of a woman in 1977, and I've been out now for a couple of years, and I teach nonviolence and domestic violence prevention and anger management. First thing I want to do is apologize to anybody in this room who's been the victim of a crime." And, they'd never found the person who killed my mom. So it was the actual first apology that I received. Going around the room, and he meets my eyes. I start weeping. And so this whole idea that I was there to heal or to be a helper was inverted completely, that I was there to see and receive that deeply needed apology and to begin another level of my own healing. So the yoga stuff not only brought me back into my body and into sort of like, oh, I can manage all of my emotions, but it also put me on a path to working in the prisons and working on anything that's excluded in the world, any population that we push away, and looking at opportunities for reconciliation. Yoga means union, and it has become union with the breath and the body. It has become union between my authentic self and the ripping away of masks, and it has become a union practice to try and do more connection in the world. It's been profound for me, in other words.
That's such a great story, and I really want to hear that, because yoga has become much more pervasive in the 15 years since we first met, but there's still a bunch of people out there who haven't done it yet, and they're wondering, oh, what is this new agey stuff? Is this for me? And I think it's important to realize that people don't start out as yoga people. Nobody really does. And so this is a practice that's available to everybody, and it's a way to really reconnect with the self at that deep level that you just mentioned.
I think that a lot of it, even now I'll go into a gym practice or like a physical practice, and it'll just feel like gymnastics. And so I would just say, do that with a grain of salt. Any practice is better than no practice, but the deeper work is when you get super quiet and your breath and your body, your movements are joined, and in the quiet is when all the insight and the healing happens. It's very hard to do that in a rock and roll class. Those can be fun, but that's not where the work, the transformation happens.
But even easier than yoga and cheaper, since it doesn't require a class to go to, how about meditation? You mentioned some of that and the science around it in your book.
I think meditation is a lot harder than yoga.
Fair enough.
Cheaper. It's cheaper. It doesn't require any, you don't have to even leave your room. It's got a very low tax. You can do it anywhere you want to do it. But when you first begin practicing, I find that to be an override of the conditioned, busy mind that needs to happen. To be able to sit in stillness in the first couple of, the first year even, I would say, of practicing, like a few minutes in and my mind was racing around. And I think that's commonly reported by people who practice. But the the longer you sit, what I've learned to do to be able to drop in anywhere is to get very still in my body and just to start watching my breath and watch it come in and out as if it was a big round circle. And when it gets to the top, not hold it, just let it keep going. And then to bring my attention, if you can imagine, kind of like you were rolling your eyes up in your head towards the forehead. And what you feel is like the muscles around your eyes relax slightly. And as the muscles and the tension there goes away, and you sort of look up and into the head, that the mind is instantly calmed. And those things are just beginner tips to kind of get you into a place where you can sit. And it's in the sitting that all of the noise of your life begins to pass in front of you. You may occasionally experience the state of absence of thought, which some people think of as meditation, but you just like watch things go and these insights come. And pretty soon you can look at anything actively happening in your own life, you've been ruminating on, problems that you've been having, and they will dissipate or the answer will become clear because you've mastered your mind. You've done the training work just like a muscle to master your own mind and become non-reactive to the situation or to your thoughts.
Yeah, and it's right there. It's always available, and you don't have to change into Lululemon. You don't have to get in your car, go anywhere. It's right there. I've been talking about meditation, how transformative it's been for years, so I'm just really glad when other people bring their own experiences, how they got into it, and what it does for them. Now, to go back to that topic of connection and connecting with people deeply, which is the topic of this talk, actually. So a lot of the people who are on this call listening are my readers, and they came here as a result of being exposed to the Tao of Dating and my blog. And so they're interested in connection. They're interested in especially finding relationships in which they connect deeply. And there are potential downsides to being like super duper open, letting people and connecting. So what can you say about having boundaries and protecting yourself from people with potentially not pure intent?
Well, you know a little of my story that I've had some exposure to a few people who didn't have pure intent. And the first thing I want to say is you can survive any of that stuff. So the minute your heart wants to shut down for any reason, just give it a nice little talking to and say, I know you want to shut down and self-protect, but the only way to find joy is to remain open and to continue seeking. And you can survive anything that might come your way that's negative. So making a vow to staying open and staying loving and staying available no matter what happens is, I think, a foundational idea. Now, I've been hurt by people. I've had wounding relationships. And, you know, I wish some of that stuff hadn't happened, for sure. But if I, in response to a bad relationship, then shut down my willingness to love and to be available, then I am the one who suffers in the long term. So that's the first thing. The other thing I would say is that systemically we have put a lot of pressure on the dyad, on the partnership, on finding the love of your life, on getting married. And that, has created somewhat of a transactional approach to relationship where we want somebody to be a certain thing for us. I've seen some of these women, these dating books where women write about, you know, their criteria, you know, and it becomes a way of diminishing. Like if a man wants to date a woman, he'll make a list of the things he wants about her, or a woman does the same thing in reverse, and it diminishes people into this list. Instead of being interested in the actual, deeply flawed, complicated, beautiful human being that's in front of you, like, who are you really? Show me who you really are, and I will show you who I really am. And if there's a meeting where we're suitable for each other, how delightful. And if there's not, that's okay, too. I'm going to bless you in that. I hope you find somebody where it, but this where that is a match. But this sort of dance of expectation and judgment that we often bring into romantic relationships does no one any good. So I'll be in a relationship with someone and 6 months in find out that there's a whole nother layer to them that I knew nothing about. What am I going to do? Be disappointed that they weren't what I thought they were, or be grateful that they showed or revealed their true self at that point? This sort of way of approaching love relationships excludes predators. You know, I do feel that there are people who are predatorial, and that the surest way to protect yourself from those people is a trusted network. You know, get to know their friends and family early on. You know, get to know the fabric in which they live. Don't treat it as don't stay in isolated relationship for very long. Feel your own core reactions. Like, are they pushing your, is there a manipulation happening where they've sensed what your weaknesses are and now they're kind of playing with you? Like, feel into that and trust your own gut when that's happening. And keep your, and then there are some places where I would just say, I don't cross the line for a really long time, like around finances or children or things like that, because there are definitely some people out there who don't have our best interests at heart. But barring those people, I think you can survive anything. Was that cogent? I sort of lost the thread there at the end.
That made all kinds of sense, and I think it's profound, the whole idea that with maximum openness and this meticulous attention to connection, that's how you can actually sniff out the people who aren't good for you. Because if you're doing this faux dance of, hey, let me put my best foot forward, you put your best foot forward, let's see what's on each other's online profiles, that's when you get blindsided by something you weren't expecting. But if you actually approach it with this idea of total openness, that's kind of strangely protective, it seems.
Yeah. I will also say, this is not in the book, but since we're talking relationships, I dated a guy for a while, and I was really into him, and he was pushing some things in me that were really old, like a desire to be coddled and taken care of and, you know, adored, all kinds of things that you would naturally expect you'd want if you didn't have a decent mom or, you know, whatever. Those are still there. They're still there. So what he was exposing to me is, you know, my own places where I still wasn't developed. So I overlooked a lot of my own warning signs for the relationship being bad, because he was was playing right into the places where I was least developed. So now I have a little awareness of, oh, when someone's playing into the, oh, I'll take care of you, Christine, pattern, that's probably a good place for me to pause and say, am I really in integrity here? Is this person really good for me? It's not mutually exclusive, but it's definitely a place to pause. But anyway, I think what I was saying is that the places in relationship that are playing into old patterns, we can become aware of when those patterns are happening and interrupt them before we go through the same cycle of disappointment that might have come before.
So much of this seems to have to do with being emotionally aware and kind of feeling into our own bodies. So what's a way that people can do more of that and pay attention to these signals coming from the body?
This is a great question. This goes back to the yoga on some level, but let's talk about, like, I'll do anger as an example. So anger in the body shows up as a tingling in the extremities initially. It's a rising emotion, which means that it's perceived at the edges and it rises from the bottom, and it kind of like heats you up. And as it rises, it'll heat your face up and you get a little agitation in the upper chest. So when I know, oh wow, I'm feeling that in my body, I become aware of the bodily evidence that these kinds of hormones are running in my system, and this is what might happen if I let it rise and I don't, and I'm not aware of it. If I let it rise and I'm not aware of it, it'll either come up to the throat and then get stuffed back down and repressed because I'm a very good girl and I would never yell at you or swear at you, or it will explode out and I will yell and go crazy and whatever. But if I can become aware of it rising, and then right as it hits sort of the middle of the heart, like breathe, okay, that's what that is, and let it pass through me, not act, not yell, scream, throw things, whatever, not act, then I can be, I have the opportunity to remember what I felt like when I was in my wisest, coolest, most curious place, let the emotion pass, and then speak from that wisdom place. And usually the interaction is pretty good at that point. And every emotion, jealousy, anger, fear, that's negative, has similar warning signs that once you're tuning into your body, you can call out. What I've learned to do is if I feel something that I can't identify or that's coming on really fast, is to just put myself on a timeout. Like I actually said this to my partner maybe six weeks ago. I said, I'm feeling something really intense. I'm going to go take a timeout. I'll be back in 10 minutes. And he just looked at me and said, thumbs up, you know, go for it. I went in the other room and I lay down in the bed and I stewed for a few minutes. What was that about? And then, you know, got clear on it. And then I came out and I was able to speak to him coherently. And it was just really loving. And I think that is a life triumph in a way, to be able to do that.
That's so wise, and it also comes straight out of research done by John Gottman and Company in the Love Lab, which I believe you quote and talk about in the book, and how, you know, there's ways of handling this stuff and not shutting down and stonewalling. It's not becoming defensive. It's not exercising contempt or criticism. It's all about, hey, look, if I say, look, I'm not disconnecting from you, I'm not dissing you, I'm just going to go for a 10-minute time, I'll be right back. Guess what? You come back and things will go a lot better.
Yeah, I think, too, because of my unique sort of mixture, he's learned also, right, that the stepping away. There's a fantastic book. If you haven't read Attached, it's a must-read on what happens to people when they're young and their attachment styles are formed and how that shows up in adult love relationships. Anyway, so my unique formula is, whoa, I can feel threatened, the threat of loss fairly easily in an intimate relationship. Of course, intimate relationship is the hardest place to apply any of these practices. Like, it's fairly easy when you're by yourself, and it's fairly easy when the risk isn't that high, but intimate relationship is the most difficult place to apply these things you've learned. So, you know, now he's learned to take care of me in the sense of saying, I love you and I am going to, go think about some things and not turning it into high drama and just going and taking the time. But that was a learned behavior for both of us, and involved some just kindness, I think, like a kindness and a willingness to take care of each other. It's not all like grit your teeth and bear it. You know, it's okay to ask your partner to help you.
So we talked about connection at the level of self to others. We've talked about connection to self, intrapersonal connection. And the book is also a lot about building community. And I think it's particularly relevant in our day and age because there's a record number of people living alone in the country and there's a record number of single people in the country. So my question to you is, community is such a deep need for being human and living a flourishing, happy life. And, you know, for millions of years we lived in tribes and there's always people around, and now that's just not the case. So how do you build community? How do you ground it? How do you make it work?
Well, I'll tell a little short story about when my son was in the seventh grade, goes to junior high, and he comes home super upset. He's like, I don't have any friends. Nobody likes me. I should get a haircut like this. Maybe I should get these rugby shirts with these collars. Maybe I should join the basketball team. You know, just kind of going through this, like, what do I do to be accepted and liked? And we said, we had a little talk, and I said, well, you know, if you do those things, you'll probably make some fake friends who like you for these reasons. And then you'll probably get a fake girlfriend who likes you for these fake reasons, and get a fake job, and then get a fake life. And, you know, by the time you're 40 or 50, you'll have built all this fakeness on top of each other, and then you'll get a real divorce, and then you will find yourself. Like, I'm talking to my 14-year-old like that, or 13-year-old like that. And so I think the first step is, you know, any community that you build or become a part of has to be approached with deep authenticity about who you really are for it to be lasting. And that it is not done digitally. Like, this guy, John Chichopo at the University of Chicago, did some research on how people who are lonely use social media versus how people who have rich community use social media. And the people who are lonely, it exacerbates their loneliness. But the people who have community use their social media presence and activity as leverage to increase their offline connection. So number one, is it, you know, authentic? And it has to be face-to-face. It has to be in person. So you have to pick one or two places where you are showing up in person, meeting people, and it has to be consistent to build trust and a genuine sense of caring and shared purpose. It has to be consistent physical presence with another group of people. Now, in a mobile world and a place where people are commuting a lot, that's not super easy. Civic engagement, church involvement, all that stuff is like at an all-time low in history. So there's a question of conscious design. Like in my case, I host book readings and salons at the house, and I host musical events and sing with other people, do dinner parties, which are pain sometimes. You know, you just want to like collapse, but then, hey, if I put some dinner on and have the soup pot going and others will come, it's amazing what shows up. So that's more informal. We've also grounded community, like every Wednesday night, have people come over and just break bread with no purpose. And that's also a way. And you don't have to initiate it all yourself. You can just join in. But this old-fashioned, I'm looking at you, I'm showing up for you, I'm showing up as my authentic self, we have a shared purpose, I'm not wavering, I will be here, is really vital. And if you don't have it because of your life design, then that really should be up for a question. Is my life designed in a way that will build my health and well-being and my ability to be present with others, or not? And if it's not, all that other stuff doesn't really seem to matter in the end.
That's super powerful, and I'm such a big fan of that. And I throw events myself, and I've been to some of your events, and that it is the way to build community. I mean, just we're not these point masses kind of floating through air. We're looking to be part of more robust networks and opening your home to other people. I mean, if you feel like something like this is lacking in your life, then here's an opportunity to take the initiative and make it happen. Design the happiness, creating event into your life. That totally does work. So a lot of the people who are listening are here because they are looking for some kind of love, and that's actually pretty much every human on the planet. But these people are specifically reading a book called The Tao of Dating, perhaps. And so you have had a variety of experiences when it comes to relationships. And, you know, some of them very enriching, some of them very painful. So my question to you is, after all that you've been through, what have you learned about the ingredients for a happy, healthy love life?
Love yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
Allow people to be themselves fully. You know, don't...
Allow people to be themselves fully.
Yeah, allow others to fully be themselves. To expand on that a slight bit, because it can be telepathic in a way. My partner notices that I get reactive to something that he says, and he begins hiding little parts of himself in his life. And suddenly, you know, I don't really know him. I really am most interested in knowing who he is. And so if I deny the parts that I find unpleasant or that I am afraid of or whatever, I'm never going to know him. And the more that he closes off, then the more lonely he will feel, and it will never thrive. And so I'm super interested in what my partner's authentic experience of day-to-day life is. That's the second ingredient. The third one for me has been just a sense of waking up and making it a practice to be grateful for his mere presence. You know, just to like look at him with wonder, like what a complex and beautiful creature, and to be grateful for his presence, even when, you know, there's something funky going on in day-to-day life. So I give him there's a beautiful phrase. I give him safe passage through my mind. Do you know what I'm saying? That sometimes our minds are not a safe place for our beloveds to be. You know, we might judge them or hold harsh thoughts about them. But if I say, I will always give you the benefit of any doubts that may arise, I'll put you on the good side of that, and my mind will be a safe place for you to walk through. So that's the second. And I think there is no substitute for shared time. And the book that does the sort of five love languages thing, the touch, is it kind words, blah, blah, blah. They talk about shared time, but I find that to be unique, not in that you don't, that you can feel loved without having a lot of time, but to know a person takes daily or frequent interaction, because people are changing every single day, you know, little slight trajectory shifts because of what they see or what they learn or what they think. And the ability to sustain something over the long term seems to be really tied to knowing, growing together in some of those directions. I mean, I had a 17-year marriage and a 10-year marriage, and I would say the first one was so beautiful, the father of my babies, but, you know, that ended for medical reasons. It didn't end because there was any major break in communication. We're still connected. But the second one was growing apart through some traumatic stuff, and I really see in retrospect the how that might have been different, and that's what I'm practicing now. So self-love, letting your partner be themselves fully, being truly interested in who they are, and staying tuned in to the changes and growth that happens every single day. I think those are the three things that have worked the best for me. And lots of play time.
Shared time, including play.
Mm-hmm.
And ladies and gentlemen who are listening, I am here with Christine Marie Mason, and we're talking about her brand new book, Indivisible, Coming Home to Deep Connection. And we have another 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so before we open to questions. And if you are interested in asking Christine a question, you can do so by pressing 5-star on your keyboard. When you press 5-star, a tiny little hand will appear here on my screen. I will know that it's you. And then I will come to you, and you will ask the question. And then we can go on. So thank you for your attention, everybody. And let's get back to the interview here. So you've written a book, and that's quite an undertaking. And how did you – and I think a lot of people who – are listening right now, they've had similar experiences, and perhaps they have lots to teach. In fact, I've declared this month to be the Wisdom of Women Month, where my readers share their stories and I share it with the rest of the community. So how did you write this book? You said it was a challenging, deeply personal project for you. So how was the process?
The process was highly variable. I would say, like, I go through periods of great productivity and periods of great self-doubt, but it was a discipline. Like, I wrote every morning a page every morning. Sometimes I'd write a couple of pages, and when I got about 300 pages, the book's 220, so I could do about 300 pages, and then I stepped back, and I said, all right, well, how is this shaping up? And then I got an editor, and the editor, God, just with all appreciation, really wanted me to push the book in the direction of more of telling the personal story, like sort of a heartfelt, very female story, you know. But I still love science, you know. I love neuroscience and genetics and neurobiology and networks and, you know, social theory. I like the science. I didn't want to leave that out. And so then the next step was to identify sort of what was the balance going to be between personal story or narrative and science and data. And how are we going to strike that tone? This doesn't appeal to the same type of reader. Like, people who tuned out the heart stuff were turned on by the science, and people who loved the heart stuff glossed over, like they said, you know, I glazed over at the science part. So, you know, that was the next step, and I would say I got hung up there for quite a while on how to strike that tone, and it ended up being more personal than was comfortable and probably less scientific than some of my more analytical friends would have appreciated. But I felt good about the balance. And then the sort of nuts and bolts of editing. And so many other ideas came up during the writing, like sticking on tasks, sticking on this project, and putting the other ones in a drawer for later. I would say, if you have a creative impulse in you or something that wants to be said, like, how many friends do you have that have died unexpectedly or something's happened to them? My friend Jeff Klein, who passed at 50, totally healthy, just died in his sleep. You know, there's no time to not do it. And so small daily movement in the right direction, like this joyful, like, I'm doing my thing and it's going to come out, that becomes a practice. And then once you make that commitment and you're doing the practice, like, getting the people on board who are your allies, others who believe in your story, others who feel like they want to create with you some sort of a mutual support on having your creative work manifest. Anybody who's not positive about your ability to finish or the meaningfulness of your work, just excommunicate them until the project's done. I mean, don't, like, excommunicate them as a person, you know, love them up, but don't include them in this. I think of the creative process as a greenhouse, and your work is still in a tender shoot stage until you really get to an editable form that can be banged on by somebody else. And that stage, you need nurturers. You need other people who will challenge you, but with the belief in your work. And I was really lucky to have a group of people like that. But it's been a job. So I cleared my plate of several other work-oriented projects to make space for this, and treated it like it was a job. The last point on that is, as long as you treat the thing that you love as a hobby, it will never advance. My writing and work on these topics did not begin to move in the world until I treated it with equal weight as my job. If I thought of it as a hobby, it died on the vine. So that was a big internal shift before the practice began.
Well, I'm very glad you did, and I'm certain that many, many people who will be reading your book will also be glad that you did that. And I want to emphasize that question, because so much of people's lives is about these priorities that were not determined by themselves. And somehow the dream gets forgotten. Suddenly you're 75 years old. It's like, ah, I had this book in me. I had the symphony in me. I had, I don't know, this dance in me, and I never got to express it. So you are a person who, more than anybody I know, has accomplished a stupendous amount of stuff. And, you know, you ran 9 TEDx's, you started these companies, you were hired to be CEO, and somewhere in there also raised, you know, 4 fantastic kids, and then took on 2 more from another union. And so I just want to convey to the listeners that this is possible. And also, if you, you know, on close observation, if you read the book, you know, this can happen even when all the other stuff is going on, even if you don't necessarily have a huge gift for your organization, it's not about having every second of your day accounted for. It's just about making the thing that you love a priority and making sure it's not just a hobby anymore, like Christine just said. I think that's such a powerful thing. And it goes, you know, this is about connecting to your dreams and connecting to your goals and the vision of who you want to be. So we have time for maybe one more question or two more questions. And so every book has an audience, and you've written this for someone out there. And my question to you is, what would you like readers to take away from this book? If they were to take one action after reading your book, what would it be that would make the whole exercise worthwhile for you and also for the readers?
One action?
Well, you can go on, but you start small.
I would say, look, question any belief that makes you separate from someone else. That creates division, and move in the world in inquiry, practicing connection first. I had a little download. This is also not in the book, you know, but spirituality and all that it's got an undefined and amorphous quality to it. And religion has a lot of baggage. And so we don't have a language for the development of the connection that is outside of those two realms. And so I got this sort of hit that spirituality is simply an awareness of the foundational interconnection between all things, matter, invisibilia, whatever. And that spiritual living on some level is the attempt to stay in that awareness in how you act in the world, how you treat others when your ego doesn't want that. Your ego wants to be small and separate. It doesn't want to remember that it's always connected, that it's always interacting with others at an energetic level, that you impact people the way you walk in a room and they govern you right back. And so that spirituality and spiritual living is highly tied to this concept of living with the awareness of connection. And that anything in our lives that creates division or doubt flies in the face of that. Is something that we should question. We might question and override with active choice.
That is powerful and just easy to remember, and I think it radiates out into any number of different aspects of life. And those of you who have not had a chance to get the book yet, it's now available. You can get it. And it's really a remarkable document. I mean, it's a combination of many different things. It's a travelogue. You know, there's all these stories of going from place to place, road trips. It's a love story, several love stories. It's a bit of a building's roman, except it's not a room. It's a novel at all. It's real life. It's actually happened to Christine every bit of the way. And, you know, she grew up in Illinois and Germany and Iran and lived around the country in all these different places. And, it's, to me, this guide to a very well-rounded, richer, more flourishing life. And I think anybody who reads it is bound to take away something along the lines of what you just said, which is to stop for a moment, reconsider that idea of separation, look at the person in front of you, and opt for connection instead of separation. So I hope all of you have a chance to read the book. And now is the time for us to ask questions. So if you have questions, you may raise your hand by pressing 5-star. I know this is tricky, but it has worked in the past. So if you press 5-star, your hand will raise and I will call on you. In the meantime, Christine, anything else you'd like to add? Anything that you really, really want to share with our audience that I did not get a chance to ask you?
I think the piece that we haven't talked about is the movement from the life of the self or the life of your immediate relations into the echo that produces in the culture, you know, what we are designing. And I feel, you know, particularly right now with all the divisiveness and hate and, you know, trolling that's going on online around these elections, you know, the data about the number of people we have locked up, the way we've put our elders into remote places where they're not observed or included, that basically if we start to see the way the culture is designed as an echo of the internal separation, it takes on a completely different tone. You know, once I started to say, oh, wow, all of these behaviors are symptoms of disconnection and separation, they have the same root cause, I started to feel a lot more hope. Because if I can work on the connection day to day, and I can work on inclusion and acceptance and inquiry, it's a pretty profound shift, not just for me, but for the design of our institutions and culture.
Fantastic. That's a great way to end the interview. And once again, if you have questions, please press 5-star, and I will call upon you. If you don't have questions, that's okay too, and we can we'll wait for a few moments to see if people actually figure out this 5-star business. Christine, thank you so much for your time, and also for writing this book and being so candid and sharing everything that's happened in your very interesting and very eventful life. I think that's what really gives the book so much vitality and so much relatability. And ladies, gentlemen, buy a copy for yourself and 10 for your friends, and hope you get a lot out of it. So going once, going twice, going 3 times. If you don't have any questions, we're going to close this interview. So, Christine, thank you so much. And the name of the book, once again, is Indivisible, available for purchase on Amazon. And I've interviewed today Christine Marie Mason, the author of the book, on David's release. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Christine, for your time.
Thank you, Allie. Talk to you soon. Good night, everyone.